It is Saturday, December 1st, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, the week in geek news, and in the second half, your questions and comments of technology.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, we are covering the week in geek news. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join the conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us, and I'll give that contact information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447.
This afternoon at 5 p.m., the Planet Cruise Comedy Hour with Richard Stockton returns. The show includes comedy by Mark Pita, revolutionary songs by the Raging Grannies, and the latest blues from Planet Cruise by your host Richard Stockton. That's the Planet Cruise Comedy Hour with Richard Stockton, 5 p.m., this afternoon on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
I've got a call for musicians. GeekSpeak is looking for a new theme. If you got an idea for a song, or if you're a musician and you want to write something, give us an email. Go to geekspeak.org and use the contact form. And in the subject line, go ahead and put new theme, something like that. We're looking for something that's catchy, probably no words, and something we can use for the top of every show and in the middle and in the end. And let us know what you think. I'm just sick of that theme song. I mean, it's been 7 years. You know what I mean, geeks?
You're not paying royalties on that.
Well, you know, BMI is. Yeah, there's a group that's actually giving the money to the original musicians. Welcome to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems.
Good morning, Lyle.
Miles Elam did a little read just a second ago.
Good morning.
Student slacker. You're not really a slacker.
No, not lately.
Are you a multi-slacker?
No, actually, I'm not a slacker at all.
You're really busy.
Yeah.
Yeah, try having kids. student at Cabrillo College, a tutor at Cabrillo College as well.
And so in a sense, I do have kids.
I think you still are.
Does some young child that you love a lot wake you up in the morning kicking you in the head? Does that happen to you? Regular? No.
Well, I got a girlfriend who kicks me. Well, I guess she doesn't kick me in the head.
She's young, but not that young. And we have Timothy Jordan. Timothy, hi.
Hey there.
You know, in my script, I don't have like a what you are kind of thing.
A title?
Yeah. You want to give me a title somewhere? Masters of Fine Arts? Ooh. In digital arts and
Master
media.
Master Jordan. I'll go with that.
Master Jordan. I'm not going to do that every week.
Forget it. You can call me Young Master if you'd like.
Padawan. No, welcome, Timothy.
Thank
welcome,
you.
Geeks. Let's start with some geek news from Miles.
The BBC, the website that everyone knows and loves regarding their news organization, World Renown, have used a technology called Ruby on Rails.
I love Ruby on Rails, personally.
Right, for maintaining their site. However, they were finding that the Ruby interpreter was not fast enough for their needs. BBC, their website is a highly trafficked site. If any of you have used Firefox, you'll see that it's installed by default as one of the bookmarks. So what they've done is they've used Perl.
Why do you reference that? That it's installed as one of the bookmarks in Firefox? To show its popularity?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons why I think it is more popular with a lot of audiences is that it's just there as a news source.
Mm-hmm.
However, Perl, the virtual machine interpreter for Perl, is much faster. It's been around much longer and had more time to be tuned for speed. And so what the BBC has done is created a Perl on Rails. In other words, all of the API of Rails, but in the Perl language and for the Perl interpreter.
And a Perl interpreter is older, which means it's faster. I mean, why is Perl specifically?
Why is Perl faster?
Why is Perl faster than Ruby?
Because it's been around for longer and people have optimized it. Okay. I mean, really, it comes down to how much time you spend on a project and how much people that know how to optimize software.
Is it about optimization of the runtime engine, or is it about Perl was built designed in a different way? Like, Ruby's very friendly to users.
No, the first iterations of Perl were probably comparable to Ruby, if not slower. But in more recent years, Perl has basically does a runtime compilation of some code. It's a very advanced VM in terms of interpretive languages.
Virtual machine,
right. And it's been around for, 20 years, thereabouts?
You're pretty familiar with Perl, correct?
Yes.
Are you familiar with Ruby at all?
Only in passing.
And what is your thought on this? In respect to the language itself as a programmer, which one would you prefer using? Or is it unfair because you know Perl so much better than Ruby?
Well, I do know Perl better. I don't code in Perl all that much anymore. I do find them to be fairly similar. I mean, they're doing many of the same tasks. Ruby tends to be, I guess, more aesthetic from like the modern language aesthetic.
Well, let me ask you this. Is anyone doing Python on Rails?
Yes.
Well, that sounds appealing.
Yes, although I don't know that Python on Rails would be faster than Ruby on Rails. From what I understand, Perl, the virtual machine, is still faster than the other two.
Well, thank you very much for the update on what the BBC is doing. Do you think this is a turning point in the Rails development, or is it such a small thing it doesn't seem to really matter?
No, it's just a geeky thing of note that I thought people would be interested in.
Yeah. I do a lot of Ruby on Rails development for work and for pleasure and...
Well, what does Rails give you? I mean,
yeah, what does the Rails mean?
I don't know. So,
Lyle, like, you say Python on Rails as if that changes the Python language somehow. Yeah. I don't get it.
It's an
Rails,
API.
Yeah. Rails is an API, a framework for doing web development. Ah. So,
Just web development.
It's mostly designed for web development.
But it's handling like database interaction.
Yeah. So it makes a persistent object. It makes a model object that you interface with the database. So in the scripting language, you're never doing SQL. Kind of like in PHP, sometimes you actually have SQL fragments in the page. That just doesn't
all
happen.
Over the place.
Right. So instead, you're using a library that's generic library for finding records and accessing records.
Ah.
And the back end is all handled by Rails. So it's a framework.
So it's all object oriented and nice.
It is. It's very fun to do. I'll throw you through the code sometime update the site.
Yeah,
it's so much fun.
Yeah, the reason why Ruby was chosen or was created as the initial language for Rails is because with Ruby, they were aiming for the smallest amount of code possible to still get the job done. And so you end up with this very terse, very short code that it makes assumptions about what you're going to do. And so if you don't specify it, it just does a default.
Yeah. Like, for example, functions you don't have to wrap parentheses around. It'll figure it out for you. There's a lot of, like, shortcutty kind of things, which makes the code very readable. But that's what I was questioning, whether the speed of the Perl interpreter has to do with syntax not having to figure out syntax.
I would think not.
Okay.
I think it was very much about
Perl's syntax is very variable.
It is still variable.
If I remember correctly, there's 20 different ways to do the same statement.
That's one of the complaints people have when they start learning Ruby, is that it seems so terse that it's kind of like when people write abstracted Perl or obfuscated Perl, when it's really hard to understand Perl because it's really easy to put one giant
single
thing
line programs.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, it's an interesting
idea. Perl got the reputation also because of regular expressions, so that's going to affect every language.
Yeah.
It's just the
regular expressions.
Yes, they are wonderful.
Red chefs.
I think we've gotten geeky enough. We've lost 20.
Yeah, regular expressions, for the audience that doesn't know, is a pattern matching syntax.
For programming.
Right.
And if you're dealing with strings, that is arrays of characters, you really need regex, right?
Yeah, to be able to say this is a phone number, for example, or this is a zip code, or things like that.
Text comparative analysis.
Yes.
Okay. Let's.
There's the heavy term.
Let's go to the next news story. Timothy?
Sure. Sure. So this is all about the Comcast controversy concerning internet infringement.
Could you have added more C's to that?
I couldn't help the alliteration. It just
I know.
Came
that's
out.
A wonderful alliteration.
We've covered this story before.
Yeah.
It's,
so
has to do with Comcast, like, looking at what people's data is. Can you explain a little
bit? Yeah, this is nothing new. Comcast is interfering with internet traffic. We know this.
Of their customers.
Of their customers, yes.
Seems
exactly.
Like not a good thing to do.
No, you wouldn't think so. Now, before, as you may have suspected, it was just a suspicion. But now we have proof.
Pretty well documented.
Yeah, pretty well documented. Okay. But now we have proof. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has come out with a program for network experts to actually install on their machines and install on target machines so you can detect if these forgeries are occurring. Now, let me backtrack and explain the issue just a little bit. So prioritizing is nothing new, right? Let's say you have peer-to-peer network traffic and you have IM traffic. Well, at heavy times of the day, peer-to-peer traffic, you know, it takes a lot of bandwidth and it doesn't need to be responsive. You sort of start it up and you expect to come back a few hours later and have your files. Whereas IMing, you want to IM your friend and have them get it right away.
Right.
So Comcast will say, well, if I get both these packets of information at the same time, I'll send along the IM right away and I'll then send all along the peer-to-peer packet. So that's all well and good, and they're very wise to do that. So you may be experiencing, you know, internet slowness at certain times of the day with certain types of traffic, and that's okay. Until we get a fast enough network, network neutrality is never really going to be up to that point. Well, let's suppose another scenario. Now, these packets, essentially, let's say I write you a letter, Lyle.
Okay.
Now, this letter gets broken up into multiple packets.
Is it on the computer? Because I'm not going to read it if it's in the mail.
It's email.
Okay, good.
It's email.
Good.
Okay. It's none of this snail mail stuff.
So you send me a long message, and it gets broken into little packets.
Little packets. Now, some of them go over through Ryder here, and he passes them along to you, and some of them go over...
Through Miles. Okay.
I can't believe you forgot my name.
I you know what the funny thing is? I even wrote it down here. There it is. Miles.
You're reading this?
No. Oh, well, okay. I have notes. So and
wait,
I
let me get this straight. So my name is written down and you've still forgotten?
It has to do with your face, Miles. Don't take it personally. So
you have a face for radio. I admit it.
So I sent some packets to Miles here. I'm patting him on his shoulder.
Okay.
Hope
there,
that's
there's some touching here. I think it's annoying.
And he sends it along to you. Well, let's say Miles decides to send the packets along to you, but he also forges a disconnect packet.
A packet which says the letter's over.
Says the letter's over, stop receiving packets.
And so
very cruel of you, Miles.
That was mean,
just
Miles.
Say.
Yeah, you're going to make me cry.
And so then any other packets I get, I'm going to ignore?
Well, there's, you know, I mean, a number of different things could happen. If it's a peer-to-peer program and it's intelligent, it might say, okay, well, I'll stop and then I'll try again in a moment.
Uh-huh.
So, right? So it'll just maybe make a hiccup.
So that's what Comcast has been doing, is kind of inserting these stop talking about this
exactly.
messages?
They've been forging disconnect packages and sending them along to both sides of the network. So if I'm doing peer-to-peer file sharing with you, Lyle, I mean, as we know, peer-to-peer file sharing, the bandwidth increases as the number of peers enter a certain file sharing network.
Right.
So we're all sharing my letter to you, and Ryder over here wants to read it, and Miles wants to read it, and so we're all sending it along. But if you and I are sending each other disconnect packets, then we're going to be taken out of the network, and all of a sudden that transfer between all of us is going to go much slower.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're essentially doing through this forgery is
killing the experience, but it makes it it breaks it basically. But why? Well, Miles, what was your point?
Well, this is a curious thing: is if we are all on the same Comcast segment, then it's probably cheaper for Comcast for them to allow peer-to-peer
Right, they're probably
access.
Only doing this between in and out of their access.
Right, because and, within
and
their...
They're not doing it globally. It's kind of isolated.
Okay, so let's
still
say...
It's horrible.
Let's say there's let's say
there's... it's impacting
Don't
me.
Don't hold back.
I mean,
tell us how you
I
really
cannot
feel
seed,
about it.
I cannot seed a single file. I mean, I've had all sorts of stuff that I you know, legal stuff to push out that I want to share. And not a single – it'll seed for like 5 seconds and then disappear.
Yeah.
Normally
It sounds like you need to get this tool. So what is this tool?
No.
This tool is just an observation tool.
Oh. Yeah. There's no fix for it yet.
Yeah, no. I've talked to Peter Eckersley at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and their big concern, the reason that they're publishing the software and they're gathering information, is that this debilitates internet creation.
Freedom.
Freedom. If, say, I'm an internet innovator, let's just pretend for a moment that I am. Oh,
gosh, you have all this money.
But let's say I wanted to write a tool for the internet. All of a sudden, I'm going to have in mind, well, what if Comcast or all these other ISPs don't like my particular traffic?
Right.
So they throw the monkey wrench into my innovation.
Okay, why? You said that there's technically you can prioritize packet delivery so that Comcast could say, you know, let's make these packets slower, let's reduce the bandwidth, let's throttle this
a
little
bit.
Why didn't they do that rather than disable it completely? Why don't they just say, you know what, all of our customers have, they can only use 10% of their available traffic with this peer-to-peer stuff. Would that be technically very difficult?
Well, bandwidth shaping and prioritizing are two very different things, right? Let's say prioritizing is more like you and I arrived at the same intersection at the same time. Who's ever on the right gets to go first. Yeah,
right.
This is really simple prioritizing that we do. But the thing is that I still get to go next.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if another person
doesn't
right
really,
behind
it doesn't
you,
really affect the traffic like shaping would.
Yeah. No. Now shaping is a much more complex thing, and it requires
shaping's more like the lights going on the freeway for traffic control, where it's just a stop mm-hmm. a stoplight on the side of the track.
Yeah, like the metering onto a freeway.
Yeah.
For example, that might be considered shaping.
Okay. So they're not doing that though. Couldn't they do? Isn't it technically feasible for them to say, you know what, all BitTorrent traffic, all peer to peer traffic has to be reduced so that there's always enough access for other traffic.
Yeah, I guess, but you'd have to think, how would you do that with
peer-to-peer
traffic?
It's technically hard.
Because let's say, yeah, it's technically difficult, and this, in a way, may be accomplishing just that,
right,
is the thing.
Well,
because if there are the five of us, the four of us, in this peer-to-peer file-sharing network, how do we get the bandwidth to decrease? Well, we disconnect one of us. And
right.
How do we do that? We send a disconnect packet.
Okay, but technically my network traffic, my feed, my upload and download speed can be controlled, can't it?
I guess they could hold your packet and then send it along moments later.
It's an interesting dilemma. Okay,
they could
so
queue them.
So this tool allows you to see whether this is happening or not. So, Ryder,
exactly,
you should get this tool and see if that's really the issue
now,
or if it's something else.
I can tell.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, it's very dramatic.
The force is strong with this one.
Yeah.
Well, and let's also cut through this. The reason why some ISPs would do this, like Comcast, is the fact that ISPs, or commercial ISPs for personal use, are... they're basically overselling. It's kind of like airlines, where they may sell more tickets for a plane that they have, a
right,
flight that they have available, because on average it works out. But every once in a while it goes more. So they don't, if they have, let's say an ISP has 3,000 customers, they don't have the bandwidth of, let's say, 3 megabits a second for a
every
typical package,
mm-hmm,
times 3,000. They have it more like 3 megabits times 500.
Right.
And it's just assuming that not everyone's going to be using it at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then at certain times, things are going to get slower. That's where peer-to-peer kind of puts a monkey wrench in this, is that a lot of times you have it just sitting in the background. And so you're using a much greater amount of that bandwidth than what their models had planned for with
right,
just web use and email.
Okay, so this seems like a complete disaster from a marketing perspective or a PR perspective to have been caught doing this. Because it's not the same as restricting what you can do on the network with some kind of policy in place. It's a blind decision they've made to break a technology that you can use. And that seems to me pretty bad PR.
They pretty much adamantly state that they're not blocking, they're not breaking
they're
functionality
not
of the application.
Traffic.
They consider this a network management policy network management policy.
But you effectively have a service you can't run on your network. And if you had DSL, you'd be able to run it.
You can run it.
You
just not as well.
You cannot share files effectively. You can share files with other Comcast members. I mean, part of this, you know, an unstated, you know, benefit to Comcast is that they don't have to worry so much about their user base distributing copyrighted material.
Yeah, but they cannot get into place of managing that, because once they do, they're responsible.
Well, that's not. I mean, and you know, that's why they don't state that.
Yeah.
You know, publicly. I mean, what they're doing is they're basically controlling their bandwidth. You know, they're mm-hmm, making sure that they can share the experience for all their users, and that you don't have a select few that are gobbling up all the network.
So right now, if you're moving into a new house and you had to get network service, would you guys all avoid Comcast?
It depends on what you use it for. I mean, if you just download stuff and you're not somebody that needs to distribute files out using BitTorrent technologies, then it doesn't really matter to you.
Unfortunately, I think the decision whether to get Comcast or not really is based around what cable access do you have, mm-hmm, and do you need cable internet over DSL.
Right.
A lot of people are moving into new apartments now and not getting phones. They're relying on their cell phone service for their phone. And if you have to get DSL, then you have to get a phone line.
Right.
So you might as well just get cable internet. So
assuming you like TV.
It's a pricing selection. You know, cable is more expensive.
So these are more important factors than whether BitTorrent will function correctly.
Unfortunately.
Some people want high bandwidth internet access so that they can get stuff from BitTorrent. So, it's not going to work well for them. I mean, overall, this will affect availability. I mean, it depends. I mean, as you have other cable providers implementing the same sort of restrictive technology, it becomes worse for everybody that uses BitTorrent.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a wonderful, I mean, like Miles is saying, that it's kind of silly that they break it to some sense that when your Comcast customers, like my local neighborhood, sharing a file is really inexpensive for the Comcast system because it doesn't go to the internet. It goes locally only. Mm-hmm. And so kind of making that service less effective in general, not that they're stopping that kind of traffic, but they make the service less available, they're kind of reducing the possibility of having like generalized local data stores of users.
I would be curious to see, like, for example, this monitoring software, to see if they're performing this on your own computer, whether they do a preferential treatment for things that are coming from over the internet, or whether they just leave the local
I'd be curious about
alone.
That too.
All right. Well, so anyway, if you want to learn more about this issue, check out
geekspeak.org.
Geekspeak.org. And the link to the Electronic Frontier Foundation's article will be put on there.
Great.
And a note for those of you that are thinking that you'll go out and get this utility right away and install it, be careful. It's for, as DFF says, network experts only. It requires all sorts of utilities and lots of manual install and some scripting.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's not for everybody yet.
Not yet.
I think
they're
make
working
a tool
on
that will be public like that. Where
my understanding is that they're talking about that.
I kind of like it because it would be kind of like a meter of how much freedom you have on the net. I like that idea. The last news story until we start taking calls, though, we might do some more news. Let's go with Ryder.
Okay. So interesting discovery with the Leopard, the new Mac OS release. Some developers, I'm not sure developers or users that were using the Wine emulator, which allows emulating Windows applications on non-Windows environments. They were messing around with this on Leopard, and they discovered that the Leopard OS application loader was sort of checking and trying to load Windows libraries natively that it never did before. And this sort of leads to speculation that Mac OS could basically run Windows applications natively in the future.
You mean that it looked like
Wine type
support?
There's basically some built-in dynamic loader, you know, executables, basically guts that are looking for Windows particular dynamic libraries.
So that's why it's not as stable.
Oh. Now, this is somewhat speculation at this point because it could be some sort of leftover from the new EFI, the extendable firmware interface. Interface that is used on Mac desktops and laptops when they switched over to the Intel architecture. They use this new, rather than the old BIOS interface that you see on most PCs, they switched to this EFI.
So it could be that this is just a side effect of
that. It could be a side effect of implementing that technology, but
but the rumors always run wild when somebody finds something interesting like
that. And this wasn't there in Tiger, so that sort of, you know, leads to that, you know, this is something that they might be, you know, setting the framework for.
So the next Macworld might have an announcement of that. Let's find that. But so I switched to Leopard a couple of days ago from Tiger on my PowerBook. And
how does it feel?
Or MacBook Pro. It feels a lot faster to do most things. I really like virtual desktops that supports whatever it's called. What is it called on the Mac? It's called
The memory usage is supposed to be a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, I've been pretty happy, though I had to restart this morning. I normally don't have to restart my machine very often, and I hate a few things quite a bit, which have been frustrating. Ryder just fixed one of them for me, this reflective dock on the bottom of the...
You guys hate it. I kind of like it.
That's because you're a geek. We all are. Why do you like it? It just looks cluttered to me.
Well, I like the eye candy.
That it looks clever.
Yeah. See, I don't like the blue dots. Can you see which applications are
active? The blue dots, I can see them. I've gotten used to them.
Oh, okay.
You can change that.
But they're not immediately obvious. How do you change it?
You have to go into the resource files for the dock.
Ryder just gave me the information on turning off your reflective dock, which I used.
It's in the preferences, right?
No, it's not a preference thing.
Really?
It's a script thing.
If you put it on the side, it becomes really different, doesn't it?
The preference on the side, it doesn't do the reflective thing. Unless you turn your head side. No.
Right. Now, I have a copy of Tiger, the previous release of OS X, and I'm looking side by side, and I'm sorry, I really like the black arrows much better. I
think black arrows are much more clear than this sort of translucent blue hovering dot right below the icon.
Right, and you don't
have you get on Leopard.
And you don't have the back of what's meant to be a slanted plane.
So you run this little hack, and it gets rid of this lines of plane, and then it turns the blue dots into a white dot, and it's on the black.
Oh, so that's as if it were on the side, but it's on the bottom.
Yeah.
Looks much better.
And for everybody else that's not in the room, I just showed my image. Yeah. Okay,
I don't typically use the dock to switch between applications, though. I must admit that. I use Apple Tab.
Yes, but how do you launch applications?
With Quicksilver.
Yeah. Writer, do you use Quicksilver?
You know, I've played with it. I'm not too much.
There's some apps that I'm not sold on from the dock. You know, I have a few down there that I just don't want to type in the characters for.
Well, you know, people are really saying that Spotlight kind of effectively works as an application loader now because it's fast enough to find stuff.
Oh, God, it was so slow.
Which does?
Before.
Oh, Spotlight?
Spotlight.
Oh, you know, I haven't even launched it yet.
Yeah, it's a lot faster.
It's not as fast as Quicksilver.
Okay, so, no, Quicksilver is just so speedy. I love it. Now, the thing is, other people use Butler, which I haven't implemented yet, but I'm thinking
I've heard
about
of this.
It.
It's like the new Quicksilver.
So I was still very surprised that Leopard, from all reports that I've seen on the net, I haven't switched over to it personally yet, is less stable than Tiger.
Yeah, like the network operations, accessing network shares are, I've had to disconnect and reconnect to servers way more than I ever had to in Tiger.
Yeah. I can't remember the last time I saw a gray screen of death, the Mac equivalent of the blue screen of death for Windows. I can't remember the last time I've had it when I've had Tiger on there, and yet I've heard many reports of people getting it.
I haven't had one the last 2 days.
I've had four since I switched.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
I got one, but I was messing with the developer edition of the ZFS.
Okay, so that's not...
Mine were all from hot plugging. I hot plugged the USB connection to an Apple monitor and crashed.
Really? That shouldn't do that.
Well, it had a dongle plugged into it.
Uh-huh.
So there it was probably the dongle.
Those dongles, well, you know, man. I was doing a hot plug of the ZFS drive on Minecraft too, so maybe.
Oh, hot plugging drives.
And an audio device I hot plugged through FireWire and it crashed.
Huh. Okay. GeekSpeak is on KOSP is supported by Cruise.io, providing local internet service, including DSL, computer care, classes, and website builders. Information about Cruise.io memberships available online at Cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. You're listening to Geek Speak. The geeks in the room are Timothy Jordan, Ryder Brooks, Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. 655-KUSP. Of course, you can use the internet. Just go to geekspeak.org to send us email. Stay with KUSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. And I'm not sure what Susan will be doing. We were on it last week, so I assure you it'll be better this week. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. And we're taking your calls. Again, the phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. Okay, so is our recommendation to wait on doing Leopard?
Well, it depends.
Oh, come on. That's a weak answer, right?
For most users, yeah, I would think so.
The issues are not consistent. They're kind of across the board. I mean, I've got three coworkers that have all installed it. Some haven't heard a word from, some complaints left and right. So it really depends on what you were implementing before. I mean, if you were a new user going to Leopard and you have no Apple experience, I'd say go for it. You're probably not going to notice... any instabilities you might experience or inconsistencies are not going to be any worse than if you bought a new PC with Vista on it. So
yeah, it's not like buying Vista. Oh,
man, no, but if you were a Tiger user, let's say you were a Power Tiger user, and you had your system all decked out and you upgraded. And I say this because one of my coworkers is this, and he says this is the worst release yet.
Okay, I've only been working on it for 2 days, but I did a clean install. One thing is that I got a new hard drive, a 7200 RPM hard drive, compared to a 5400 RPM hard drive. So the speed increases of the iOS might just be because of the hard drive. But I feel like it's a little faster. I feel like network connecting to SMB drives is just a lot easier or a little more stable. It's not disconnecting from a network share is not the trouble it used to be. I mean, that interface seems better. Yeah, I've had more stability. Now, I've only been doing it for 2 days. I don't know. I've only been doing it for 2 days, but additionally, I'm a pretty heavy power user. I've got different apps on installed already, and the migration seemed to have run all of it. I haven't tested Ruby on Rails to see if it works, but like my Apache 2 installation, mm-hmm. I had to change one little config file entry. Apache's working fine with PHP enabled, and I didn't have to reinstall. So I just migrated my op directory. I use Mac ports. Mm-hmm. Any case, so from my experience, I've been impressed with how little I've had to deal with, and I like a couple of the features. I like Spaces, for example. Let's start taking some calls. Is that what you're giving that little hang loose
sign? Hang loose, man. Hang loose on the phone line.
Yeah, people are definitely calling. Okay, let's go ahead and take a call from Aptos. Julie, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, no problem. What's your question?
Great. You know, while you guys were chatting, I think I might have figured it out.
Sweet. We help everyone.
I have a ThinkPad R60 that I just got a few months ago, and it's been disappointingly slow. And yes, it does have Vista on it. Is it possible that because I listen to I have the Pandora radio station that I kind of tend to listen to while I'm doing my other stuff. Could that be what's making that? Could that be part of it?
Absolutely. Your computer will run really slow unless you're listening to KOSP all the time on a radio. So what,
what browser do you run it in?
Windows.
Are you using Internet Explorer or Firefox?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've noticed in Firefox, I don't know about Internet Explorer, I've noticed in Firefox, Pandora, over time, after I've been listening to the station for a couple hours, does affect a strong performance decrease in my system overall.
So you could recommend like every hour turning it off,
yes.
Shutting down Pandora, closing the browser, maybe completely and restarting.
Yes.
Starting it.
Now, in the case of Internet Explorer, shutting down the browser is not necessarily an easy thing.
No, you got to restart the machine, I think.
Yeah. Or you can, I believe, log out and log back in. That'll restart the browser.
So that's one thing. That kind of makes sense. There's a caching thing that's going on with Flash applications. And I think Pandora's all Flash, isn't that right?
It is.
And so the browser's going to cache data that gets sent to it to make it easier for the application to reuse the data. But when you're streaming like that, you never actually Pandora never really reuses it. So it's a bit of an issue. I would make sure, of course, to get the most recent Flash update. It's possible that Adobe's released a more current Flash player based on Vista usage problems. So I would make sure to get the most recent download of that. And then I think the solution is to log out and log back in. The other thing you could do is if you don't want to restart your browser all the time is get a second browser installed and just use that browser for Pandora with that browser having the home page of Pandora. And then you can just restart the browser whenever you want and open it back up and you'll be clearing all the cache. And you could go ahead and use Firefox to do that.
Oh, great.
But I think you're probably right. I think it's probably Pandora. Another thing to do is just, you know, restart your machine. Don't play music from Pandora. Listen to KOSP. And then and then just see if your performance does not decrease or stays the same.
How often do you restart your machine?
Daily.
Daily. That's enough. Those ThinkPads are excellent machines, by the way. That was a wise PC purchase.
It's a good machine.
Oh, good to hear that.
Thank you, Julie. Good luck.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
From Monterey, Ginny?
Yeah.
Hi, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I have a question about, I'm going to purchase a laptop. I have an old computer that I'm going to get rid of, a PC. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking into just having a laptop, not a desk, you know, not a desktop system. And so I'm looking at the Macs and talking to people and doing, you know, research with Consumer Reports. I just want to know what you think of, is it the Notepad? I think, is that what they call it?
It's called the MacBook or the, yeah.
Yeah, the notebook. Right, the notebook.
MacBook.
That's what I'm considering. But I also read that they're coming out, I think you talked about it. Is it Leopard?
Leopard's an operating system. I think if you buy a new laptop from Apple right now, you will get Leopard.
You absolutely will. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's already out. That's right.
What features are you looking for in a laptop? Are you looking for ultra portability, or are you looking for battery life?
Portability and, yeah, battery life too. Okay. I'm going to start working on a website, and so I've had people tell me that it's more user-friendly on a Mac than it is on a PC to do that. I don't know if that's...
You probably heard that from Mac users.
Yeah.
Everyone has their preferences.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, the people that are using Macs, I think, are right.
Of course, in this room, on this room, there's four of us. We all have MacBook Pros.
It's whatever you're used to.
I'm a recent Mac convert, so I've come from many years of PC usage. And have you used Macintoshes before?
I have not.
Okay. I would recommend, you know, going to an Apple store and taking a look at what they have.
And she'll definitely buy one.
Well, let me say this. I mean, from a hardware perspective, a design perspective, Macintoshes are really nice. I mean, I've had many laptop PCs, and they're clunky and funky, and they have different problems. So Apple really has going for them this consistency, a really nice design, ultra portable. I mean, I have a MacBook Pro 15 inch, and it's lighter and sleeker. And just it's a really nice machine. They are expensive, is the downside.
Right.
So it is really nice. And also, Macintosh is coming out. There's rumor that Apple is coming out with a new ultra portable device in the beginning of the new year. Hmm. So I think these are, what are the 12 inch screens?
I didn't know about these.
Yeah.
This is one of the
you mean like, yeah, it's Newton? Like when they do their annual, expo thing.
Right.
Yeah. That's what they're going to. Supposedly.
Wait, but that's the thing. Supposedly, these rumors with Mac.
Yeah.
You never know.
But it's going to come sooner or later. Okay. I mean, they've ordered hardware for LCD screens. Okay. It's going to come out.
Right. Ultra portable and web development don't really go hand in hand.
They don't. So that's why I asked this question. Is like ultra portable in this case is going to be smaller, lighter, and extended battery life, presumably.
You know what? I got to be the voice of dissent here. A Mac is my primary environment, and yes, I do web development on it. However, it's a pain to test websites and develop for them on the Mac if you don't have a Windows and Internet Explorer specifically handy. Yeah.
That's a good point.
I actually run two laptops when I do web development. I have the MacBook Pro running, and I have a ThinkPad. I have a T40 that I use to test Internet Explorer, and I also test with Firefox and Safari on the PC as well.
So there is very, very much an argument for having a PC so you can test with Internet Explorer, Firefox, and Safari now.
Oh, I see. You don't need a Mac to test with their browsers because you can use...
Exactly.
Okay.
And their Windows Safari does render exactly like the Mac one does.
That's true.
I can use the PC I still have as long as it lasts to check what I'm doing.
There you go. And if you found that you were on the road and you didn't have your other machine with you, you can also run Parallels, which is what I do when I don't have my ThinkPad. I run Parallels, and using its coherent system, I just have an Internet Explorer window running amongst all my Mac windows.
Right. Absolutely a viable solution as long as you're willing to shell out the extra money for a second Windows license and $80 for Parallels.
But she has Windows, so she could theoretically install that Windows.
Unless she has the OEM version, which is what most people have.
So I guess our solution is you're not going to be unhappy with a MacBook or a MacBook Pro, and you don't have to wait for Leopard because it's already available. So your next decision is whether you're okay with switching to an Apple. Yeah. And keep in mind that you should take a look at your entire experience on the Windows machine and make sure there's a viable solution on the Mac. Like, there's some apps you cannot run on a Macintosh.
Don't forget that you can also use Bootcamp. You can boot to Windows now with the new Intel Mac. So if for some reason you decide you don't like the hardware but don't like the OS, you can always run Windows on it.
Thank you so much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hi.
From my hometown of Ben Lomond, Aya, welcome.
Thank you so much. I really enjoy your show every Saturday.
Oh, thank you.
I'm innocent when it comes to computers, and I bought a rebuilt Mac, one of those high towers, and I've had problems with it ever since. But my problem is it finally did crash. I had to force quit a lot of programs, mostly Word, but at one point it just completely crashed. My problem is I want to see if I personally can retrieve my favorites, which I did not back up.
So you were doing some backup, but you weren't backing up your favorites?
No, I didn't back up nothing.
And this is in Internet Explorer's My Favorites?
Yes.
Okay, when you say it's completely crashed, did you have to reinstall the operating system?
I took it down to Dave's, as you had recommended, your show recommended, and they... I don't remember what was wrong, but it got going again, but still Word doesn't work. But is there anything I can do about the favorites?
Did you say Word doesn't work?
I have to, I have to force quit it, and sometimes it just won't come up.
Okay. Well, it really depends on what Dave's did. If they wiped your hard drive and reinstalled the OS, there's no simple way of getting that data back. I wouldn't call it impossible because it's technically possible, but... It's not something you can do. And then if they've just, like, cleaned up some things and ran, like, a sweep of your machine or something, depending on what they did, it's possible that data's still there. But it's not a simple solution to get it back. Basically, if you're not seeing my favorites, it means it's not in your My Documents, My Favorites folder.
Yeah, it's definitely not there. I've looked.
Have you checked to see if there's a second user on your machine?
What does that mean?
Well, you can actually have multiple users at the same time installed on a computer. And the way to check that is if you open up the C drive and you look into My Documents. I'm sorry, you look into
Documents and Settings.
Documents and Settings. You should see an All and You and maybe a Visitor, I think it is, or
it would be guest, Administrator, and then your user account, typically.
And if there's two accounts that are kind of like you, it's possible it's in one of those other folders. So you could look around in there. And then most likely it's gone, unfortunately.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much.
I got a question for you. Mm-hmm. Did Dave say, is this dry? Can we wipe this data? What did they talk to you about when you actually brought the machine in?
I was just concerned about retrieving some of my documents, which turned out to be, user. So those were okay, but it was the favorite, and I didn't actually...
No, so before you brought it down, you copied some stuff over? Or when you brought it in, you
no,
said,
no,
I
didn't,
need this data?
I didn't back up nothing.
Okay, so you brought it in, you said, hey, I really need this data, and they said, okay, we'll take care of the data for you?
No, they didn't. I couldn't afford that part of the thing, but now I'm going to try to go and afford it.
Okay, so but the only thing you really wish you had is your favorites.
Yeah, because I did years and years of research, and...
Okay, so
I learned my lesson.
So when you brought it into them, then they said they would give it back to you without the data. You didn't pay extra to keep the data.
Yeah, I didn't pay extra.
Okay, that makes sense to some degree. All right.
But now I'm going to.
Yeah, well,
if it's still there.
The cheapest way to deal with protecting your data is to get a backup solution that you're religious about, and just make sure you're always backing up, and you do it intelligently so you're not overwriting and possibly backing up with a bad file. So there's definitely ways to do that. I would go ahead and invest in a backup solution. Windows actually has a pretty good backup utility built in. Go ahead and start using that. And you need a second hard drive, like an external hard drive.
Yeah, I always found it easiest to get, or like when recommending to folks, those external like Macster or Western Digital
with things, the one button?
With the one button press.
Yeah, yep. MyBook things.
Yeah, any backup solution hard drive, like external hard drive, like a USB external hard drive you can buy at a store, that have like a button on for a one press, it means it's also going to come with software that will do exactly that. You plug your drive in, you push the button, it's going to run an application, copy all your data, make sure it's safe, and then you can disconnect that drive again. So it's kind of a built-in solution for exactly the reason that you don't want to
ever delete. What's that called?
It's just a backup.
There are many of them. So what you're looking for is like a one press or one button. It'll be on the box.
Yeah, basically, cool. It's called an external hard drive, a USB external hard drive, and it should tout a one button backup solution.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the call.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. We have Miles Elam, Timothy Jordan, Ryder Brooks. I said that a little strange, didn't I? Sorry, Ryder. And we're taking calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. From Santa Cruz. Aw, we lost Blaze. That's too bad. All right, let's go with Carmel. Francis, welcome to Geek Speak. Hello, Francis.
Hello.
Hello, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good. I have two questions for you.
All right.
After I tell you that I could not send an email on your website.
Did it give you an error message?
It said, we can only take 3 messages. Please try again later.
Yeah. Sometime when we get inundated with email messages, it slows down. Sorry about that.
So then I went to the KUSP website and typed out a whole message and pushed send, and then it said, sorry. It did not go through. So anyway, here are my two questions. One is, do you have a simple password program, a shareware thing that will just be a place for me to type in my passwords? I don't want any automatic thing. So that the program will then print out a list for me.
So you want to have something that you type in passwords?
Yeah.
Like a text file? I don't know, what kind of service do you want with this?
I think he wants a password manager, something that will say you have a master password that you type in, and then it will present all the sites and all your accounts and all your passwords, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it could even type it out.
Yeah. There are several of these out there. I don't have one personally. I don't personally use them, so I can't recommend one.
Are you talking about like a plugin for the browser? So
no. You want a utility that does this, right? Not something built into your web browser.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, they're called password managers.
So basically, something that you would deal with, you go to a site and you're like, oh, I have an account here. You'd go over to a different application. You'd open it up and you say, I want my password for blah, 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 and it would give it to you, and then you paste it into the... Is that what you're talking about?
Even simpler. I just want to be able to type it in. It's going to arrange it alphabetically, and then it will print it out, and then I have this hidden list in my desk drawer.
I wouldn't recommend doing that. I can understand the appeal for doing that, but that sort of defeats the purpose of having accounts and passwords.
People's homes are pretty secure, so the idea
they
of
are, but,
out
but you're talking.
Your
I mean, if you do online banking and things like that, it's just really not a good idea. I mean, anybody breaks into your house,
How about if he has a simple mnemonic with the printed out thing that it's actually that password split in half and reversed or something like that, where it's you can't read it easily.
Right. So I would leave off the banking stuff and put everything else. Because there's a million passwords that people want.
Well, I know a lot of people that just have a pad of paper that goes in their drawer and they write their stuff down there, and they don't even put it on the computer. And that's an option. I don't have a quick solution for this. What I do have, I mean, I can tell you what I have, but I use a you're on a Windows machine, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm on a Macintosh machine, and I've got a secure an encrypted mount. It's kind of equivalent to an ISO file, but a DMG file, which is like a hard drive, and it's stored on my hard drive, and it's encrypted with a heavy password. And inside there is a text document that has all my passwords in it. So I just put it in a text document and just make sure it's encrypted on my machine. And that's functional, and I could print that if I wanted to. So that's kind of a simple solution you could do. And on a Windows machine, I don't know if there's something equivalent to that. Anybody?
There are lots of things out there.
Do you use Word?
I do.
You could just password protect a Word file. How secure is that?
Not very.
Oh.
I would recommend using one of these password managers. If you just do a simple Google search and search for Windows password manager, you'll get a lot of things. And there are open source free versions that you can use. Now that from a secure perspective for what's on your computer, typically how they all work is that they have a master password that encrypts the database that it uses. So everything is encrypted, and you have to, when you open up your application, you have to type in one password to remember, and then it'll give you a list of all of them. And I'm sure some of these utilities will give you an option to print out all your accounts information.
Francis, what's your second question or comment?
Nick Negroponte is touting the one laptop for every child in the world, and it's supposed to be $100, but it's now $200.
Right.
And if you buy one for $400, one goes to Africa and you get one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you have tried this new computer.
I've ordered two, and actually that means two are being donated for work purposes. They have not come in yet. I expect them to come in next week or the following week. And as soon as I have them in my hands, I'll have two in the air room. We're going to borrow them from UCSC, play with them, tell you what they're like. But I can tell you right away that it's definitely for kids. They're designed for children, and they're not equivalent to a Windows laptop, in that you won't be able to do all the things that you can do on your Windows laptop on one of these. And
your email, though, right?
You can check email, you can browse the internet, but it's
a
different.
You can look at videos.
You can look at videos, and you can take pictures, and you can take videos. But it's going to be, it's like a different operating system, right? So it's kind of like the Windows and Mac choice, which one you want to go. This is a new one. And the user base yet in the U.S. is very slow. So they're small. So I'm not sure my recommendation at this point. I still think that the price is amazing. And I look forward to it, how it will impact the globe, and I'm very optimistic about that, but I'm a bit of a futurist. So,
do they still wind up?
They do have a charging device that you can use.
They don't have a lever or a...
It's a yo-yo thing. It's like a ball that you pull.
Yeah, exactly.
That has a gyroscopic thing on it. So it's got a string and a ball, and you pull it.
Or at least that's one of the many ways of
like
charging it.
You can talking also get Woody dolls.
Yes. You can also get a donkey and have it go around in a circle and charge it with a motor.
Eventually, they're supposed to have a solar panel.
That's you, another one of the charging options.
You could get a solar panel, too. I don't think I'm going to be getting any options except for plug-in when I get these, but I'm not really sure. Because I think the other charging options are really defined about around the area. So if you've got a small area that has a lot of sunlight, then you're going to give them solar panels. And if you've got an area that's in a rainforest with kids, you're going to see if they've got oxen that can charge them, or you're going to give them these little things that they pull. So you really set up the powering infrastructure based on their environment. If they've got power, then they just use the power there. Well, thank you very much for the call. And just so stay tuned on GeekSpeak, probably the month of December, we'll be talking about it quite a bit because we'll have some in our hands. Thank you, Francis, for the call.
Bye.
I think we're going to get to one more call today, and I think it's going to be from Bonnie Dune. Catherine, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, thank you so much. I am trying to transfer old cassettes to CDs, and I'm doing it on a PowerBook G4 using Audacity.
Uh-huh. And
the program Audacity, it's a
good sound application.
Yeah, it is. My problem is coming in that I have 80-minute CDs and I'm not even being able to get an hour onto them.
Ah.
And I don't, maybe there's a setting somewhere.
Do they stop after that period of time?
Yeah.
Do you, what are you specifically trying to do when you're taking these CDs? Oh, wait, are you burning CDs?
I'm burning CDs.
Okay, so you're mixing music or some talk or something like that, and you're trying to burn your music. You can get an hour on a CD. That's how much they hold.
Even though they say 80 minutes and 700 megabyte.
Okay, so...
The CDR.
Yeah, so then you can get that much time, though I've had unsuccess on software applications. What you're probably having is the applications not knowing that that's a larger disk than standard. But let me ask you, what are you using to actually burn the disk?
I was using iTunes, though I was considering changing to Toast. Maybe it would be a little bit more responsive.
Yeah, I'd probably agree with you on that. One thing I would ask is that, are you burning it as a data disk or...
No, as a...
As an audio disc.
Audio.
And you can, and iTunes isn't doing it for you. That seems very strange. So you take the WAV file that you save from Audacity, you load it into iTunes, and then you say, and you put it into a playlist, and you choose the playlist, and you say burn, and it says it's failing.
I've been saving them as an MP3. Could that be the problem?
Well,
it's a length of time thing.
It's a length of time thing, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you're having that kind of trouble.
Me too.
I'm thinking there's another thing. Are you sure that that song, like in iTunes, shows that it's... An hour, or how long does it say?
One of them says it's 47 minutes and it cut off.
When you say it cut off, describe that.
The CD ends. With the...
The CD ends when you're playing, when you're...
Is there a one-track...
Yeah.
Do you guys know if there's a one-track restriction in
Red Book
duration?
Audio?
Oh. So the question is, so normally when people burn CDs, they burn multiple tracks. You can do this quite easily, though. You can cut your audio into two... And burn two tracks on and put it into iTunes. But when you choose those files, you've got to go into the preferences of the file and make sure they don't fade out between the two. And you should be able to get the first track will always have a delay. The second track doesn't have to have a delay, I believe, is the protocol. So that's what's happening, is the track is too long, most likely. Would you agree with that, Miles?
It hadn't even occurred to me. I don't know.
I'm grasping at straws here.
Yeah. The only thing I can think of.
I'll try breaking them into tracks.
Yeah, and if it's a 45-minute issue, if it doesn't work on that, or take a look on the CD when you're playing it back. Oh, you know, another thing is, what are you playing this with afterwards?
I'm playing it in the car.
Maybe your radio has an issue. Try it on the second CD player. Find a different CD player and see if it will play that song all the way through. Also, on your radio and your car, instead of playing it right away, go ahead and start playing it and then fast forward and see if you can get to past that point. I'm just curious, maybe the CD has the data on it and your car just fails out at a certain point on a track.
Huh.
It's a possibility at least.
Okay.
The other thing is CD players in cars, and traditionally older CD players, sometimes have a lot of difficulty with burn media, the media being not very readable. It's not a very common thing anymore, but sometimes the media itself is not as readable by the CD and the CD player. And you'll normally see that when it tries to start. So if you're not seeing a problem when it tries to start, it probably has to do with some kind of bug inside your radio in your car. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, if you've been here for the last hour, you've wasted it. GeekSpeak is over, and you've been listening to it for a full hour, and I'm so sorry. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark online tonight with David Lawrence, who's used by permission.
You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.